Hello, everybody. Talking about natural gas. So continuing on fossil fuels, we began with coal, had a lecture on oil, and now we're going to talk about natural gas. So starting with a little bit of a review, I have this image. So you have a ceiling layer that sits over on top of a reservoir rock. Within the reservoir rock, you have your fluid. And notice that within this fluid here, we have kind of two sections here, a red section sitting on top of a green section. That green section, if you follow this line here, that would be the oil-filled reservoir, okay? Following that green area. So what is the red? Well, that's gas-filled. So in other words, you know, you could have a source rock, as we see down here in this brown area, and that would be the organic-rich material that sort of creates the hydrocarbon in the first place. If that cooks for a while, eventually it's going to form oil. And if you continue cooking it, it will form natural gas. And so it's kind of like how well done is, I think I've used this analogy before, how well done is your steak, right? Is your steak really well done or is it sort of medium rare? Okay, that's sort of determining the type of hydrocarbon you're getting to some degree out of your organic material. So, you know, that organic material, some of it's really well cooked, so you're forming natural gas. In addition to oil, oftentimes these will coexist in the same reservoir. But they're separating themselves out because natural gas is going to be lighter than oil, so it's going to sit on top. So at the top of your prospect or whatnot, you're going to have natural gas, and that's going to be underlined by oil, which is then underlined by, you can see, water-filled reservoir. And this is water that, you know, may be at significant depth, and so it's probably not drinking water or water that would be suitable for drinking. It's going to be more, as we would say, chemically evolved. So, you know, just if you go deep down into the subsurface, you're going to find water down there. I'm talking thousands of feet deep, like really deep. You're going to find water down there, but it's going to be relatively evolved. So it's going to have a lot of dissolved solids in it. It might be kind of briny or saline even. And so that's probably what you're finding down here underneath your oil and gas. So just wanted to sort of review where we're at. So we're going to focus on this upper part here, the natural gas piece. And again, you know, these five play elements are listed here: reservoir, seal, trap, source, and migration pathway. You got to have a way to get that natural gas, in this case, from the source rock all the way up to the reservoir where it's accumulating here in this structural trap. Okay, and then the other thing that we also talked a bit about was refining, and this is a picture of a refinery here. You have all of these sort of stacks here, which is where distillation is occurring, okay, separating out of various hydrocarbons from the crude oil. So you start out with a barrel of crude. We saw this one before, and you can separate out, you know, various weights, if you will, of hydrocarbon, where it gets lighter and lighter and lighter as you move up the column. Okay, so at the very top, you have liquefied petroleum gas. So we're kind of back into this sort of natural gas fraction at the very top. At the very bottom here, asphalt, right? That's really thick, heavy, more tarry, viscous, but also a petroleum product, right? So we're separating out, and you can see as we move up this, we're getting lighter and lighter. And that's what we're talking about in this lecture, is really this top part here, the natural gas that exists. And it can be liquefied, right? Or it can be in its gaseous state. It really depends on the pressure and the temperature of that fluid. Okay, so what does natural gas look like, you know, throughout the world? Well, you have a map here which shows sort of import and export of natural gas. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, natural gas is kind of a unique thing in that it's not as easy to transport as oil, right? Anything that's in a gaseous state is going to be more difficult to move around the world. And so oil is generally considered to be something that's easily transported. And so its price is sort of set at the global level, right? So the price of a barrel of oil in Texas, say, is going to be the same price as a barrel of oil in Asia or in Africa or in Europe. It's globally traded, so because it can be moved around relatively easily through tankers, etc., the price ends up being the same from place to place outside of government regulations and government restrictions and or subsidies, right? A lot of governments will provide subsidies for consumers in oil, especially in some oil-rich countries like Venezuela or Saudi Arabia. So the price that the consumer sees, you know, won't necessarily be the same from country to country, but the price that a refinery, for example, is buying crude at, that price should be relatively consistent from place to place because it's easily transported. So in other words, if the price goes up in Asia, okay, then people are going to start exporting more oil to Asia because they're going to be able to get more money for it. And as you increase the supply, the price will go down. So it ends up evening out throughout the world. Natural gas is different. Natural gas is more difficult to transport, okay? And because of that, it makes it so that you have regional markets that have different prices, basically. It is able to be transported. There's technology now that exists to liquefy natural gas. So natural gas is literally gas. That's why gas is in the name, right? But if you cool that down, if you make it cold and or increase the pressure to a degree, you can liquefy it. You can cause it to change from gas into liquid. And that is easier to transport. It takes up less space. And liquids, you know, are just generally easy to transport. So what we have is these large ships, and I'm going to have a picture of one of these later, that have all these kind of spheres on them that are used to both chill, to cool, and to pressurize that natural gas so that it's liquefied. And that's how it's transported. You can see we have quite a few different lines here of movement, right? A lot of these are coming from, interestingly, Australia, from Northwest Australia. There's a large natural gas field out here in Northwest Australia, but you have very little population out there. Western Australia is very sparsely populated. And so, you know, the natural gas that's being pulled out of the ground here, out of the subsurface, needs to go somewhere. So it's being converted to LNG, liquefied natural gas, and then being shipped to markets where you have high demand. A lot of that is going to Asia. And you can see this is sort of pointing towards Japan here, but it's really a lot of it's going to Asia. You also have quite a bit that's coming from Brazil and then moving up northward into various markets. And then there's a lot of pipelines, right, that exist within the United States. So we have a lot of natural gas production. You know, what people have been doing is using this fracking technology, right, where you go into the source rock and you actually create fracture pathways so that the hydrocarbon, whatever it is, can flow out. That's basically what has resulted in, you know, is really a boom in natural gas production in the United States, which is being moved around again by pipelines within the United States. So the cost of natural gas in the United States, where we have this kind of local source, is relatively low compared to a lot of other places in the world where it's harder to get it even via LNG, right? Liquefied natural gas. And that is also affecting our energy mix in the US, which we're going to see here in a moment. It has real implications for whether or not other sources of energy are economic, and its biggest impact has been on coal, which again we'll see that in just a moment. So this shows world natural gas trade. You know, who's an importer and who is an exporter. These here on the left are going to be net exporters, so they're producing a lot of natural gas, and then these ones down here are going to be importers, so they're importing it, bringing it in from elsewhere. And, you know, a lot of this is going to be probably pretty self-explanatory things that you may expect. You can see Australia is here, Russia, okay, very big exporter of natural gas. They have a lot of it, and that is a huge part of their economy. So we're going to talk about that in just a moment in regards to the Ukraine war and how that's affected things. And then on the right side, actually, I'm going to have to get my picture out of here just for a second. So on the right side, we have this bar graph, right, which shows world reserves of natural gas presented as for oil. And another figure, okay, so we have world reserves. You can see in millions of cubic feet here. And, you know, who has the most? Well, Eastern Europe and Russia is sort of a large piece of that, and then the Middle East. That's where most of your natural gas exists in the world. And this sort of came out in a table that we were looking at in a previous lecture as well. Okay, so let's move on. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in Ukraine. I think this is, you know, it's a timely topic and something that is very much affecting the global supply of fossil fuels, whether we're talking about natural gas or otherwise. And it's, you know, it's something that's happening today, so worth discussing a bit. This Gazprom Rosneft shares tumble, but the energy giants are Putin's safety net. So, you know, in other words, these large state oil and gas producers, which they are, they're owned by the state, so they're nationalized companies, you know, their sort of profits, if you will, are expected to go down in some cases because the demand for their product is going down. And a lot of that is because of sanctions, right? So the governments of the world, some governments, many of the governments, including the United States and being led in many ways by the United States, are saying that, no, you're not allowed to buy certain amounts, and the restrictions are all very nuanced and they change from time to time. But they're reducing the amount that countries are allowed to purchase from Russia. So if that demand goes down, then the price also ends up going down, right? And but regardless, you know, one of the things that's important to note here is that, let's just say hydrocarbon in general, natural gas is a big piece of that, but hydrocarbon in general is a huge source of wealth in the Russian economy, right? And that includes going towards the government. I mean, the United States is like this on some level, right? I mentioned in a previous lecture about oil and oil revenues that come from private enterprise and how a large percentage, you know, over 18% in many cases of royalties from production goes to the government and, you know, ends up being distributed in various ways. And so, you know, all countries, governments are going to benefit in some way from hydrocarbon production, etc. Some countries like Russia, Saudi Arabia, you know, a lot of Middle Eastern countries, their economy is heavily dependent upon fossil fuels. And that is absolutely the case with Russia. And so, you know, one of the things that this kind of poses is that private multinationals, things, you know, like the Exxons and the Chevrons of the world, they also oftentimes play a role and, you know, are invested in these resources. And so, you know, at a time like this, you know, where war is occurring, and you have all these sort of political considerations that are going on, these private companies are saying, we want to divest from, you know, Russian hydrocarbons. So, you know, what are they doing? Well, it sort of, you know, this is kind of the playbook that's been occurring. They promised to get rid of their assets, but ideally from the owner's perspective, you know, they would find a buyer, somebody to buy that so they get some money out of it, eventually sell them for some amount of money. That would be their goal. Okay, so let's continue on here, you know, again, focusing on, you know, some of the politics and economics around natural gas production, where it goes, you know, how it's being used. And I am focusing a bit on Russia only because of recent events. I think that it makes it kind of especially interesting to do so. So we have, you know, if we look at 2019 data, so this is, again, prior to the invasion, but we have, you know, in Russia, quite a bit of production and consumption of all three of the fossil fuels we've been talking about, whether we're talking about coal, natural gas, or just anything else. And you can see the production levels here pretty high. So Russia was the world's third largest producer of petroleum and other liquids, and that's after the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in 2020. You know, it generally comes down to, are you in a large country or do you happen to be in a favorable location like Saudi Arabia, which is also a fairly large country, but it's also in the Middle East, which is a super favorable location for petroleum products. Russia was the second largest producer of natural gas in 2020. Okay, and that was second to the United States, which is so interesting. I showed an image previously that showed reserves for the two, right? And reserves in Russia are much higher than the United States, but we have been very relatively efficient in producing the natural gas that we have. So our production levels are actually high, and in the case of 2019, at least higher than Russia even. Europe is Russia's main market for its oil and natural gas exports. Okay, by extension, Europe is its also main source for revenue. So this is a political conundrum that I think people are probably somewhat aware of at this point, which is that Europe depends on that energy coming from Russia, natural gas, especially during the winter for heating. But at this point in time, many European countries, you know, are opposing the invasion of Ukraine and so want to not use Russian natural gas, oil, etc., because that ultimately that money goes towards the government. So it, you know, funds in many ways the war from Russia's side of things. But they're dependent on it, right? Energy is a necessity in this day and age. And so, you know, it's really about trying to change up the mix. And we're going to talk about how that might occur in just a moment. But let's just take a look at here from 2019, Russian natural... Oh, I'm sorry, this is 2020 now. Russia's natural gas exports by destination. Look, the majority here, the vast majority is this green piece. So the vast majority is going to Europe, right? And then you have some other areas like non-OPEC Europe and Eurasia, and then Asia and Oceania. Okay, so the Asia piece is definitely getting larger in recent times. Okay, and then Russia's crude oil and condensate exports. So looking at oil this time, and you can see it's a little bit more of a mix here. And, you know, a lot of this is because of pipelines, right? Natural gas, not as easy to transport long distances on ships. You got to liquefy it. So wherever you got pipelines going, that is going to be where your natural gas is going. And there's a lot of pipelines going into Europe. Oil, on the other hand, you can send that to whatever market has the highest demand and highest price. Okay, so that's what's happening here. You get Asia having a much larger pie of that because it's easier to do so. Right, okay, so this is a more recent image here, which is showing now kind of the effect of the invasion of Ukraine. And also just what's been happening more recently. And you know, the colors on the graph aren't super easy to see. And you can see that we have LNG as a percentage shown here. That's liquefied natural gas, right? And notice what's happened since the invasion of Ukraine, which would be right about in here, kind of early 2022, okay? LNG has gone up. This is European gas supply, okay? It's gone up a bit, right? And what has happened to... this color here, which is Russian pipe. It's kind of hard to see the difference in these shades of kind of green, blue. But you can see this one here would be Russian pipe. And what happened here is it dropped quite a bit. You can kind of see that inverse relationship where LNG is increasing and pipe. And LNG, again, the reason that's increasing, that can come from anywhere, right? It could come from the United States. It could come from Brazil, et cetera, because you're shipping it. And then on the other hand, the pipeline natural gas is going down. And also, you know, just to get a sense of what that pipeline network looks like. So we have all these fields ultimately in Russia, you know, locations where it's being refined and so set to be able to ship via pipelines. And then this is what that pipeline network looks like. So you have both oil, which is shown in red here, and then you also have green, which is the natural gas pipelines, okay? And so we have these pipelines that are extending from Russia, which there's Moscow, St. Petersburg, so this is sort of the population centers, but a lot of the fields actually exist way up here in Siberia, okay? And those fossil fuels, whether it's oil or natural gas, are being shipped via pipeline, many of them, all the way into Europe to their primary markets here. You know, you got Germany, you got Italy, etc. And notice that some of these are crossing Ukraine here. Here's Belarus up here. Here's Ukraine that's sort of labeled down here. But a lot of these pipelines are crossing Ukraine. Okay, so let's get back to home here. And some of this I mentioned in a previous lecture very early on in the class. But, you know, coming back to the Northwest. Well, we also have pipelines, right? And our pipelines... many of them are coming from Canada. Much of our natural gas makes it down from Canada. Here's sort of the Portland area here. These blue areas show natural gas storage fields, right? And so you have Jackson Prairie in Washington State, and you have the Mist Field here in northwestern Oregon. And again, so natural gas is being pumped down during the summer when demand is low, and it's being stored underground in these storage facilities. These aren't like metal tanks or anything. This is just rock, right? It's just being put into pore space within rock, and then it's being produced during the winter to supplement gas that comes on the pipeline because of high demand in these urban spaces. But we have pipelines that exist throughout the Northwest bringing natural gas transmission lines as well, you know, throughout our area, our region. Right, and this is also something that we looked at, but just so, sort of as a review then, is, you know, coming again close to home. This is Portland. You have ultimately electricity generation that occurs, okay, and that's what's shown in this plant, electricity generation from natural gas, okay, and, you know, this is being supplemented by hydro as well, which is coming from dams on the Columbia River. This is the North Mist Field. Okay, that's providing natural gas both for electricity generation and for heating in the Portland area, and that is Northwest Natural Gas, the company that's doing that. Okay, one thing to note here, and I like this graph because it really makes this point. It comes from the government, from the U.S. government, but it shows how the mix of various fuels and various sources of electricity is changing rapidly in the United States. It is changing very quickly. And take a look at this. We're going from 1950 to 2020. And look what happens kind of right around here, around this point. This would be about 2008 or so. Right, what happens is the use of coal, which is this kind of orangish mustard colored curve here, coal drops from being a source that's getting close to 50% or more of our source of electricity. It drops down to where it's at closer to present, which would be even south of 20% of the mix. That's incredible. It's an incredible change, right? Over half as much electricity is being generated by coal in at least 2020, shown here, right? And what's picking up the slack, right? Well, look at natural gas. Natural gas is up to 40% in this graph, and it has been rising quickly. Okay, and this is a tricky kind of a thorny issue in some ways, because natural gas, also a fossil fuel, coal and natural gas, both fossil fuels. So a lot of the reason for the reduction in coal is because of natural gas. And is that because of policy that's in place? Well, partly. But honestly, most of that is because natural gas is being produced locally in the United States now. And a lot of that, the reason it's being produced is because of technology, again, because of fracking technology. And so we now have this source of natural gas that we didn't have the ability to produce prior, that's local, and that makes it relatively cheap. And so it is out competing in the marketplace, even outside of any government regulation, et cetera, which is playing a role. But outside, even if the government was completely laissez-faire and just like no regulation, just get whatever energy is the cheapest, right? Natural gas would be cutting into coal's market share, if you will, because it is it's local and it's now in great supply, right? So a lot of the reason for this decline in coal is because of the supply increasing in natural gas. Now, there are other things going on. There are regulations that are changing over time. And that is also playing a role. There's also the creation of, look at this other piece here that's growing, which is the forest green one here. That's renewables, right? And that's been going up. I mean, it's been going up steadily since the 50s, to be honest. But in recent times, okay, since 2010, say, or a little before, it's been increasing at a much faster rate, okay? And that's because we're putting in solar, we're putting in wind plants all over the place. If you go out to the Columbia Plateau, you go out east of the Cascades, you're going to see windmills all over the place out there. So we're supplementing electricity generation, really, with wind power. Also, it's a huge business in Texas, both solar arrays and wind generation. And these are considered renewables, right? And so they're also generating a lot more electricity than they used to be, and taking one of the other reasons you're seeing a decline in coal. And you could argue that the introduction and the increase in renewables is also mitigating the increase in natural gas, but natural gas is still rising, taking over a large piece of market share here. On one perspective, yes, it is a fossil fuel, but of the fossil fuels that exist out there, in other words, if you're going to burn a fossil fuel, make it natural gas, okay? Don't burn coal, and oil is going to be somewhere in the middle, right? But if you're going to burn a fossil fuel, you want it to be natural gas, and the reason for that is because it is the least polluting of the fossil fuels. Okay, it's the least polluting. It still releases CO2, right? It still pollutes and puts things into the air that you don't want in the air, but it does so at a much slower rate and to a much smaller degree than coal, for sure, right? And also less polluting than oil. So it's, it's kind of like the best of a bad set of bad choices, in a sense. It might be one way to look at it. But and I'll just say very much in generally, the trends that we're seeing in the last 10 years, are positive for the environment. I think that most people would argue that. Most people would say that. Some people bring up arguments about resiliency, right? And we saw blockouts in Texas, or we saw see blockouts in California, related to electricity. And some people say, hey, we need coal for those situations where the electricity demand is so high that we need something like coal to supplement and to make sure that we don't have blackouts, because renewable energy like wind and solar is less reliable in the sense that it's only being generated when the wind's blowing or when the sun is shining, and so it requires this additional element of storage, energy storage. Battery technology is not just something that is of interest for people creating electric cars. But it's also very much of interest to people who are interested in renewable sources of electricity, like wind and solar, because you want to be able to generate that electricity, when the wind is blowing, but maybe you're exceeding demand, and so in that case, you want to be able to store it for the times when the wind isn't blowing. So battery technology is a big area of research right now. Okay, so also looking close to Oregon here, this is going to be for 2019, and again, these things are changing rapidly. So sort of keep an eye on this space, right? These numbers are changing quickly. But if you look at the National Electricity Resource Mix for 2019, you can see this is the mix for 2019. And so coal, a bit over 20% in this one. More recently, it's continued to go down. Natural gas is the number one. It's pretty high. You can see hydro is way down here at 7%, which is kind of interesting. And then if you look at just Oregon, okay, this is really interesting. Look at what's happening in Oregon. Coal actually has a higher percent, right, than what's happening nationally. But hydro also takes a very large percentage, okay? Hydro goes up to 37%, while nationally it's all the way down at 7%. And why is that? Well, we got the Columbia River in our backyard, which is fully dammed up, and that is creating a lot of electricity locally. It is green energy in the sense that it is not polluting, it's not putting CO2 into the atmosphere. But there are other environmental concerns, right, around wildlife, salmon, around building up silt behind the dams, and so you don't have this natural flux of sediment going downstream. So no technology is perfect, right? I mean, that's kind of the bottom line, right? And so you end up with this situation where you're balancing pros and cons. And in the Northwest, hydro remains a very large part of that mix, okay? And this is some interesting information coming from PGE. That's Portland General Electric. Mainly things that I've mentioned before, including the shutting down of their coal plant in Boardman, which has happened. Okay, that has occurred. And then they also, have this other coal-fired plant that they're part owner on in Montana, which they are sort of working towards eliminating, basically. So yeah, watch this space. This energy mix is changing in real time, both nationally and for Oregon. And this is kind of what, the future might look like. It is already happening in Central Oregon, in Palouse Country, the Columbia Plateau, et cetera. These windmills are all over the place. The share of renewables is going to increase, but again, one of the challenges there is storage. And we'll see where that goes. So anyway, that's what I have to say about natural gas. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it.